And it is 2 o'clock. It's time now for your appointments with the Reluctant Therapist, Elizabeth Barrett. What's on your mind today, Elizabeth?
Well, today what's on my mind is that we had a guest scheduled to come and talk about their book. I'm losing my voice a little bit, so that's exciting. The guest did not show, and I am pivoting and going to see where we're going to end up today. So that's what's on my mind in the moment. And also, I'm thinking about kind of this next month ahead and the holiday rush, because those who teach and work on like a quarter system, teachers work on a semester system, whatever their time period is, there's kind of this common thing in the teachers community that we just charge through our quarter system. And then when there's a break, we do all the appointments that we couldn't fit in while we're teaching because they're so busy with school and grading papers. And just it becomes like a really crazy sprint on a wild cart. Kind of like the ride at Disneyland where you're on the runaway train.
Right.
That's kind of what that feels like. Then I just finished my ride on the runaway train. Still have some grades to input. And I can tell like my voice is tired, and it was great up until my last lecture. I am trying to keep up with my appointments, and my husband and I spent a good deal of today doing phone calls to change things. And I know that I'm not the only one who's had the experience, so I'm just sharing it to share. But we decided to change our internet and television provider.
That's a big change.
To something else.
Yeah.
And it's like trying to leave a cult to extract yourself. They would not let me off the phone. I said, I have a lot of things to do. But they just wanted to, you know, ask all these questions and what I was going to do moving forward. And I said, I don't know, and I don't think I need to share with you. And oh my goodness, that took way too long. And then I have a delivery coming, not here, but for my parents. So, you know, I can help them out. So when I made this order, I said, you cannot deliver it until I'm there to receive it because I'm 3 hours away. And then sure enough, this morning I got a notification, woohoo, good news, your delivery is coming today. Like, oh no. So I spent a good deal of time navigating that situation. And then, there was a whole thing with the bank, and my husband and I had to have a Zoom call, which I didn't even know you could do with the bank. It's just been one of those mornings. And so I was so excited to have what I consider kind of the easier shows.
Right.
That I don't have to, you know, be all set up and charging through. But then here we are. But it also looks like my guest has arrived. So that also helps quite a bit. I get offers or pitches, I guess you would call them, quite often from different publicists about books that are coming out. And most of the time I turn them down because I don't really consider the show to be a platform for authors. I really look to the show to be more of you know, a place to talk about mental health and to talk about what's happening in our lives and how do we keep up and how do we struggle. And when I interview authors, I'm mostly interested in talking about, you know, why they felt compelled to write a book. You know, what was the motivation behind that? So I got a pitch for a book called Like a Wave We Break, A Memoir of Falling Apart and Finding Myself. And I said, well, that sounds like something that we would cover here. And so that's who our guest is today, the author Jane Chen. She's a globally recognized entrepreneur, an inventor, a speaker, a leadership coach. She's the co-founder of Embrace, which was a revolutionary invention of an infant incubator that has already saved over a million babies in some of the most vulnerable communities in the world. Jane's been a TED Fellow and a Young Global Leader of the World Economic Forum. She was recognized as a Forbes Impact 30 and Schwab Foundation Social Entrepreneur of the Year, recipient of the Economist Innovation Award. She received her MBA from Stanford Graduate School of Business. I mean, just very incredibly accomplished woman, and also the entire world around her collapsed like a wave over the top of her. and set her on this journey to kind of find healing, balance, a new understanding of herself, kind of what it all is about. And so that's our focus for today. You're listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you can be part of the conversation. We open the phone lines at 805-781-3875 if you have a question for my guest or myself. You can also find me on Instagram and Facebook if you want to leave me a message there, or you can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org or podcast our show wherever it is you find your podcasts. Search for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Hit subscribe. If you leave a review, that helps other people to find us as well. So we're going to take a quick break, come back, and start our conversation with Jane Chen right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
You gotta swim, swim for your life, swim for the music that saves you when you're not so sure you'll survive. You gotta swim, and swim when it hurts. The whole world is watching, you haven't come this far to fall off the earth. The currents will pull you away from your love. Just keep your head above. I found a tidal wave begging to tear down the dawn.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And Jane, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hello, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. I'm glad you made it. I was getting a little nervous. So I introduced briefly kind of your resume and being a part of bringing Embrace into the world, and then the book you've written kind of about your experience developing Embrace and all of your achievements, and then kind of the breaking point and the reinventing of yourself. And I guess I want to start with my first question is, what was the motivation for writing the book about these experiences? Why the success part and then the whole tragic journey of healing part?
Yes. Well, I wanted to write about this book. Approach to write a book earlier on in my career in 2016. And I was approached to write a business book after an article came out about my work in the New York Times. So I kind of sat with it. And that was the first time I ever even thought about writing a book. But it didn't feel quite right then. And, you know, a number of things would happen over the next few years, including Embrace almost shutting down at, you know, 10 years into my journey. Mm-hmm. When Embrace shut down, it was probably the most devastating thing I'd experienced in my life. I'd poured 10 years of my soul into building the company, and it meant everything to me. It was my whole identity. Mm. And so at that point, I decided to go on a healing journey. I packed up a surfboard, a suitcase. I bought a one-way ticket to Indonesia, and I traveled around the world trying every healing modality that I could get my hands on. I was forced to confront what happened in my childhood. Mm-hmm. I grew up with a lot of physical violence in my home, and I had never connected the dots. That feeling so powerless throughout my childhood, that's what had motivated me to help the most powerless people in the world, mm-hmm. right? That's what had given me the drive, but there was also a shadow side of it, and that it led me to working in such unhealthy ways to the point of just complete and total burnout. And so coming out on the other side of that, as I finally began to recover and heal, I thought that's the story I want to share, because that's the story that's going to help the most people. Hmm.
So then let's start with Embrace, or we can even start a little further back. When did the idea for Embrace, the incubator that has saved a million babies around the world, when did this come to you? And were you always moving towards being an entrepreneur or an inventor?
The idea came to me when I was at Stanford doing my business degree. I had taken a class there called Design for Extreme Affordability. This was actually a class at the design school And it was all about creating technologies for people living on less than a dollar a day. So I heard about this class. I jumped at the opportunity to take it. And that year, one of the challenges that you could work on was to build a B incubator that costs 1% of the cost of a traditional incubator, which in the U.S. is $20,000. And so I teamed up with a group of graduate school students from all the different schools. Most of them were from the engineering schools. There's actually just four of us. And we started researching this problem. And what we discovered was that in many countries around the world, incubators are not accessible, not only because they're expensive, but because there's a lack of access to stable electricity. And so it was based on these insights and this research finding that we developed our incubator, which actually looks nothing like an incubator. It looks like a little sleeping bag for a baby. The core technology is a wax-like substance called a phase-change material that when melted maintains the exact same temperature of 98 degrees, human body temperature, for four to six hours at a stretch. And this can be reheated every 4 to 6 hours. And so we came up with a concept that costs a fraction of what a traditional incubator costs. It's portable, super easy to use, and it worked without constant electricity. And that's how, that was kind of the genesis of Embrace.
How excited were you when this started to come about? Because I guess my original question was, did you go into graduate school to be an inventor? Did you see that as something you would be a part of?
You know, prior to graduate school, I was doing HIV/AIDS work in places like China and sub-Saharan Africa. And so I knew I wanted to do something that had impact and that could make an impact in the lives of others. And I knew I wanted to do something in healthcare as well. But I did not imagine I would build a baby incubator.
Right.
And I did not imagine that's the company I would have started. And so I kind of knew the general direction I wanted to move in. But this opportunity kind of just, you know, landed and was the perfect thing for me to pursue in that moment.
So was it something that was embraced by the global community or by, you know, manufacturers? I don't know. Was it funded in a way that was usable right away?
Well, we had an interesting path. So we started as a nonprofit organization, and we got some funding, some early stage funding. My team and I moved to India, which is home to 40% of all the world's premature and underweight babies. And we thought we have to go to, you know, where the problem is. And so we packed up our bags. We moved to India. I lived in India for the next 4 years to get this off the ground. And, you know, was it embraced? I mean, in some ways, yes. There were many. We had many supporters and people who came to support our mission and to fund us and all of that. But we also faced countless challenges. It was way harder than we expected. And there was one challenge after the next, whether that be manufacturing or distribution or funding and what was the right business model. You know, we pivoted a few times. And so what we just kept discovering was that it was way, way harder than we had anticipated to not only develop the concept of the technology, but then to get it to people and to do it in a way that was financially sustainable. And so as we encountered all these challenges, you know, as I said, 10 years in, we ended up having to shut down the company.
The whole thing. And I think one of the things I read, part of the challenge was even getting the people, and I think Nepal, to even utilize the incubator when it was available, correct?
I mean, we experienced some moments of that. Yeah, it was like kind of behavior change. I mean, that was not like
that was an acute
a huge
factor.
Thing, but there were moments. Yeah, there were some moments where, you know, it's like you're changing someone's behavior, and so you want to make sure that not only is the technology available, but it's used, and that requires some level of behavior change.
And so when the business crashed, what were the next steps for you? Because I think that becomes the heart of the book. If you're just tuning in, my guest is Jane Shen. She is the author of a memoir, Like a Wave We Break, a memoir of falling apart and finding myself. So what was that break? Was it instantaneous when you found out you had to close down the company, or was it a slow roll? How did this come about?
I felt just devastated, like I said, and I felt broken. I was like having panic attacks. I was depressed. I couldn't sleep. I felt like a failure, you know, that this thing I poured so much of myself into, which I was also identified with, had shut down. And so that's what led me to going on a healing journey. And I thought, I just have to get away from everything, you know, to find myself again. And so that took me to first to Indonesia, but then eventually to many parts of the world. And I was willing to try everything from, you know, psychedelics to frog poisoning to, you know, every seminar I could find. And a lot of kind of serendipitous things started happening along the way. But I would say one of my biggest breakthrough moments was reading The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk. And what that book taught me was that trauma is not something that just happened in the past that stays in the past, right? Because for so much of my life, the violence that I grew up with, I knew that it happened, but I didn't think it affected me on a day-to-day level. And I thought, well, I'm just going to kind of sweep that under the rug and move on with my life. But the way trauma works is it rewires your brain and your nervous system such that you bring the past into the present. Right. And it affects every part of your life. And so I started to see this, like how my early wounds had actually driven me to A, start my company, and B, to just work again in such unhealthy ways, to work to the point of extreme burnout. But the years I lived in India, I would routinely work 80 to 100 hour weeks. I never took weekends off. I think I maybe made like one friend the 4 years that I lived in India. And part of it was driven by this deep desire to help. Yes, that was all there. And I think part of it was just these wounds I hadn't faced, right? The feeling of that powerlessness that I had not yet faced. And I think I came to understand that, you know, you can't save the world to save yourself. You really have to look at your own wounds and understand how they are driving you, how they're affecting you, how they show up in your day-to-day life. And so Bessel's book woke me up to that. And at some point in my journey, instead of just like doing more, you know, and putting on my overachiever hat and trying everything I could find, I finally slowed down enough to feel. And I think that was so important and such an important part of healing is how do we feel heartbreak? How do we feel grief and anger and fear and all the things we once suppressed, right? Because trauma is not stored in our thinking brains. It's stored in our limbic system. It's stored in the part of our brain responsible for feeling and connecting. And so the only way through that pain is to feel it. And that's really what I began to focus on. As a side note, I became so obsessed with Bessel's work that I actually stalked him until he agreed to become my therapist.
Oh, no. I thought that was interesting, too. That because I felt like there was this, like, this whole, I've had other, like, the global thought I always have is one, I wonder why it takes childhood trauma or deprivation or neglect for great innovation or celebrity or achievement to happen. Because if you look at people who've achieved things such as yourself, there is that brokenness that seems to be at the heart of all of the drive. And then there's the breaking of the person, not always, but at some point, and kind of that journey. I think there must be like a club of Elizabeth Gilbert and Tony Robbins and Mel Robbins and Cheryl Strayed, you know, of having these journeys and to have, right? And so that was one of the things that I came away from the book thinking is, does that have to be the story that in order to have something like a brace come about, could you have done that had you not had your childhood trauma experiences? Would you have had that drive, that obsessive drive without that?
I can't answer that question in terms of like, you know, do I know, would it have turned out differently? It did give me that drive, yes. But I'll say a couple things. One, that drive was not sustainable, right?
For sure.
Like at that 10-year period, I had a complete and utter mental, physical breakdown. It was terrifying. I had no idea that I could feel so fragile. And it took me at least a year and a half, if not more, to even begin to be able to work again, you know? And so it was certainly not sustainable. The other thing I'll say about this is, moving forward, I want to keep making impact in the world. You know, someone asked me, actually, do you think you'll ever do anything as impactful as Embrace? And I kind of laughed and I said, well, I actually think the next thing I'm going to do is going to be more impactful. And part of the reason why is because it comes from a healed place, right? That it comes from a place of having inner worthiness that I didn't have before. And so Gabor Mate talks about this idea of like wounded striving, right? That we seek this external validation through our work, through success, through all these things, because we didn't get our needs met as children. I think that certainly was there for me, even though it was very unconscious. And so now I want to operate from that place of wholeness and really being able to serve a mission and a purpose with love and care, while at the same time caring for myself.
I keep thinking, I don't know if you're familiar with the book Moral Ambition. It came out last year. And of course, the author's name is just flew out of my head. But he talks about taking like the brightest and best that we have, and you would obviously be considered one of them, and how to harness that energy into creating these impactful nonprofit enterprises around the world. And they actually have a whole fellowship and a program where they're training people to be able to do this work in more sustainable ways, which I find interesting because one of his theses is that people start off and they get burnt out too quickly because they have such a high drive toward things. And there has to be a more conscious and group think around how to solve world problems and not just flashes of them, which I find fascinating.
Yes. Agreed. Yep. Yeah.
And so, because, you know, I'm always coming to things from a therapeutic perspective, I really am curious about kind of the whole walking through of the intergenerational trauma and the family patterns that you discovered, and also the cultural experience, like how much of this was unique to the cultural expectations that you grew up with. I don't know if you want to start there. Did that connection feel obvious early?
I'm a first generation Taiwanese American immigrant, so I knew my culture was a part of that. And I think that's exactly what happened in my childhood. It's like, I didn't even know how to face these things because the violence was so normalized in my culture. You know? And we were taught that this was something that's just a part of the culture, right? It's totally normal, but also don't tell anybody because it's just like the Caucasian or American population wouldn't understand, right? And so I think there's a lot of kind of shame and secrecy and confusion, frankly, as a child growing up in this way. So I think there was just like that cultural element that led to me not facing these things fully earlier on. And was one of the reasons I felt really compelled to write this book, right? To start being more open about these cycles of abuse that continue to happen in our community. The other aspect of this you asked about is intergenerational trauma, and that's one of the things I really explore in the book is where my parents came from and what was the history of Taiwan and even China and Japan. I'm also part Japanese. My parents, when we moved to America, Taiwan was under martial law for 38 years, one of the longest periods of martial law in history. And during that period, hundreds of thousands of people were killed, disappeared, executed, et cetera. And so they were leaving a country that in which there was so much violence and oppression. Mm-hmm. And as I wrote this book, I really started to see, well, how does that work its way into family lineages and family systems? And I actually developed such a great deal of compassion for my family and for my parents having read this. And it's interesting because doing this healing work now, I both have a much stronger sense of what are my boundaries, right? What is okay and not okay for me? But also I have this compassion for my family. And so that's something, I think it's a dichotomy that many of us struggle with, is how do we maintain our boundaries while also having an open heart And I think the key to that is both self-compassion and compassion for others.
Yeah, and I always find it fascinating, too, with the intergenerational trauma. They found, you know, that the DNA of the generations that follow is changed by the trauma of their ancestors. And so even with all the insights we can have, we're still carrying, you know, chains of pain or trauma with us. And so I think that's always an interesting piece as well, that people can be driven or feel broken and not see where that's coming from until they recognize the connection to the generational patterns and trauma that they carry.
Yes, and I think it's why awareness is so important, because we do carry that in us. It's in our genes, right? This is all the research around epigenetics. Mm-hmm. However, we can also reverse the effects of that. That is the most exciting part to me, that once you have awareness, you can reverse the effects on that and make sure that it's not passed down to the next generation.
And that's why it's so powerful to have these connections with family members or ancestors, to know our family story. Because I always think that that historic part is so important when we're working with clients, is to have them know as much of their story and backstory as possible, because that feels like the foundation of their healing moving forward. It's like, where do you come from before we can even talk about what's happening now? And I think that is a shift in some different types of therapeutic practices.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Yeah, I agree with that.
And so when you – there's one part, too, that I keep looking at in my notes. I said I have to say this early because I'm going to forget. But, Jane, it was really interesting to me that one part in the book you said something about being encapsulated, right, being an encapsulated person. And the name of the company, you said, encapsulated my younger self, the part that is pure and loving, had been encapsulated in you. Do you remember that piece? And then I don't know if you named the company, but when I saw the name of the company, Embrace, and this, I go, that must have been a huge aha for you, or I don't know, lightning strikes, like, oh, I named my company for the thing that I was carrying deep inside of me.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of, it goes back to what we're saying, right? It's like oftentimes what we didn't work out in our childhood, we're working out in our adulthood and in our companies and in doing all these things. And I was trying to protect children in a way that I hadn't been protected. So yeah, like the story really comes full circle in the book.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And also the conscious and unconscious things that you do or that we do, you know, moving through our lives that end up having these through lines. But I always wonder, could we see those through lines earlier in our life? Like I always wonder if that's possible, you know, because I've been a therapist for 30 years. And so I've worked with people all different times in their life. And it feels like there's an opening period where people can see that they couldn't have done in their teens, 20s, and even maybe 30s, that they, you know, and Carl Jung even talked about that we can't do any deep work until we're at midlife, because we have to have enough life experience to draw into. And so I just find that fascinating. Like, could we have found these lines, even if we have all the information and the epigenetics and changing it, there has to be that opening in the psyche that it's ready to even make that.
Yes. And it's really why I chose to write a memoir and not a self-help book, you know, or a business book, because I think one of the things that can create that opening is storytelling and the power of vulnerability. Because when you read someone else's story and you see yourself in that story, that starts to create an opening. And I've been amazed by the number of people who've written to me saying, you know, your story is my story. Mm-hmm. And the number of people who've started to see a therapist or reach out, you know, to get support, that has been the most rewarding part of this book journey. And it's exactly why I wrote this book.
I know you're probably being stalked for your novel. You have your own followers now trying to get the insight. If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest today is author and globally recognized entrepreneur Jane Shen. We're talking about her book, Like a Wave We Break, A Memoir of Falling Apart and Finding Myself. We're going to take a quick break and come back and continue our conversation and open the phone lines for your calls right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
I've got to keep the calm before the storm. keep me safe, to keep me warm. Yeah, my life is what I'm fighting for. Can't part the sea, can't reach the shore. And my voice becomes the joy.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And my guest today is Jane Chen. And Jane, you're there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, good. It's hard when we're on the phone just because I can't chat with you in between. So I hope Jane knows that we're going to come back to her. But thanks for hanging on. All right. So one of the other through lines of the book is surfing, a lot of surfing stories. And did you take up surfing when you took off on your adventure in Indonesia, or was that something that had been a part of your life prior to this?
That had been a part of, I had learned it a couple years before I went on the healing journey. Mm-hmm. And actually, it's funny, I just wrote a LinkedIn post about surfing today, because surfing really taught me so much. I was on a family vacation in Hawaii, and I saw people surfing, and I just really wanted to do it. And so I found a teacher and got into it, and then became obsessed with it. And I think surfing was so helpful to me in my healing journey for a couple of reasons. The first being that it helped me get into my body, right? Mm-hmm. And I think many of us who have trauma, we dissociate and we stop feeling our bodies, and we start feeling our feelings. And it's a survival mechanism. I certainly did. And so surfing was so visceral that it forced me to be back in my body, right? It forces you to be very present. Your conditions are changing constantly out in the ocean. But it's also, you know, you're feeling the wind on your face and the water on your skin, and the feeling of like riding a wave is so incredible. And so it helped me get out of my head and into my body. And mm-hmm. it also taught me the power of presence.
Mm-hmm.
So those were a couple things. And then I started to learn the power of surrender, right? That when you're in the ocean, you're with a force that is so much bigger than you, that you simply cannot control. And so I started understanding what it meant to kind of let go and to surrender to something so much bigger than I was, while at the same time finding joy. And I think that's another thing that we can often lose connection with, is what is the thing that brings us joy, that makes us feel alive, right? And as adults, we lose that sense of play. Mm-hmm. And so it brought me there. And then the book actually opens with a scene of a wipeout.
Yes.
And so that's something else the ocean has taught me, is like, how do you, when you wipe out, you know, whether that's literally or metaphorically, we all have those breaking points in our lives. We all have challenges that we face. How do we stay calm? How do we find our way back to the surface? How do we get back out there again when something very difficult has happened to us? So these are all the things the ocean has taught me, and which surfing has taught me. And I often encourage people, you know, it doesn't have to be surfing, but what are the things that you do or that you can do that help you learn these practices for yourself?
I find surfing especially powerful. I'm part of an organization here called Operation Surf, which brings veterans out surfing, teaches mm-hmm. them to surf. And that's, being a part of that has been really amazing, because the immediate improvement in the PTSD symptoms for the veterans when they're out there, and you called it, it's, you have to be alert, you have to be in your body, you have to pay attention. So you're so immersed in the experience, all of the things that you're dragging with you have to be released, or you do wipe out.
And absolutely, absolutely. And one of the things that I also just, I think this is so healing, is, after I surf, I moved to Hawaii last year, and I surf every day now. And one of the most healing things that I do is I just float on my back in the ocean mm-hmm. when I'm done surfing.
Mm-hmm.
And I watch the clouds as they change shape. I listen to the sand underneath me, you know, the movement of the sand and the water. And I literally feel held by the ocean. Mm-hmm. And there's something so beautiful about that, to feel embraced, to feel held, and to feel kind of like nurtured by something bigger than yourself.
Hence the name of the company again. Embrace.
That's the name of the company. Yeah. And it's something I thought about in my own career, because I, you know, we Embrace reached 1 million babies this year. It was, you know, the you guys will have to read the book to find out how it happened.
So yes.
The company was saved. And as of this year, we reached over 1 million babies, which was the goal we set as students almost 2 decades ago. So that was like such an incredible milestone. But what I often say is my greatest accomplishment was actually learning how to embrace myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I almost think about my life's purpose. Now I'm, you know, moving into leadership coaching and development and really sharing all the tools I've learned in my journey with others. But I visualize often like going from embracing babies, which Embrace continues to do, and the work can, you know, work goes on, but to kind of offering that embrace to everyone, you mm-hmm. know, metaphorically. But I just believe now that every child, if every child felt safe and loved, our world would look so different mm-hmm. than it looks today, right? And so I think that also goes to the inner child in each of us, right? And I think we just, unfortunately, we live in this society where I see so many people who are wounded in kind of like key leadership positions, whether that's at the corporate level or even on a political level, who then act from a place of fear and ego and control, right? And so when we again approach our work from a healed place, then we can truly act from a place of love and compassion and purpose.
And I love the feeling of floating in the ocean that you gave too, because there also is those greater sense of Mother Earth and being held by the, you know, the waters of the ocean, which the salinity matches the womb when you're carrying a child. So there is so much metaphor in that feeling of being held in space. I think why people like deprivation tanks as well, because it's that return to that wombed sense of being held. And in your book, you talked about, because I kind of wanted to tap into some of the modalities that you used. You mentioned working with Bessel van der Kolk, but also you did psychodrama through the workshops. And I'm wondering how you enjoyed or experienced that, if it was helpful.
Yes. There were many things in my journey that helped. I would say one of the most helpful things was parts work.
Say that again, I'm sorry.
Or internal family.
Yes.
Was parts work or internal family systems?
Dick Schwartz's program?
Yes. Yes. So that is, like, I would say one of the most helpful things, which Bessel actually introduced me to, and I ended up working directly with Dick, so I was very fortunate to have the chance to do that. But parts work, for those who are unfamiliar with it, is a modality that is based on the premise that all of us consist of a multitude of parts, right? So we have parts that are there to protect us, and that could be everything from the part that's a people pleaser to the part that's the overachiever or the control freak or the perfectionist, right? And those parts are often protecting the parts of ourselves called exiles that carry more painful emotions, like the feeling of not being enough or being rejected or being just really scared and alone. And so this practice is about recognizing those parts and then relating to them differently. And instead of like criticizing or banishing or judging them, that we have compassion for all parts of ourselves. That's the name of Dick's book, No Bad Parts. Mm-hmm. And it's such a beautiful practice. It's something that I recommend to everybody. I actually have a version of it, that, like a free worksheet on my website. I'll share the resource for that later, but people can download that if they're curious to try that out or read Dick's book. But it's one of the most powerful healing modalities that I've come across. That's helped me both personally and even professionally as a leader. And it's something I've integrated into my leadership coaching practice. Psychodrama is another therapeutic modality that's it's a group healing modality. And you basically choose people in a group to play the role of your parents, and you kind of reenact things that happened in the past. And then you pick different people in a group to play the role of your ideal parents. And the idea or the goal of this is to create an imprint, kind of a more loving alternative to whatever happened in your childhood. And so I first came across this at a retreat that Bessel did that I attended. And I watched it just like do miracles for the people who participate. And I became kind of obsessed with this modality of healing. And I kind of thought to myself, well, if I just find the perfect ideal father, then I'll be fixed. I'll be whole. You know, that's going to be the magic elixir. Mm-hmm. And so for 2 years, I went around looking for the perfect ideal father. And I tried psychodrama a couple of different times. And each time it didn't quite work for me. Mm-hmm. And so finally, and this is actually the last chapter of my book, finally, I hand selected a person, a friend who could play the role of the ideal father. I wrote down every sentence I wanted my ideal father to say to me. I created kind of this perfect setup, which I thought was fail-proof. And the day came that we did this psychodrama, and my friend read every line I had written to me and, you know, read the lines perfectly. And I still felt nothing. Mm. And I was so frustrated. I thought, how could this not be working? And so I had on my coffee table a picture of myself as a 5-year-old. And I picked up that picture and I took the piece of paper that I'd written all these lines on. And I read to that little girl everything I wanted an ideal father to say to me. And I basically said to her, you know, I'm so sorry. You didn't deserve that. You are worthy and you are loved. And for the first time, that little girl believed me. Mm-hmm. And I just felt it in my body, you know, this warmth and this love. And like, I realized in that moment, everything I needed, I thought I needed from the outside, whether that was an ideal father or the perfect teacher or healer or, you know, healing modality, psychedelic, whatever it was, like all of the things I was seeking for outside of me had to come from within. Mm-hmm. And of course, every teacher healer experience helped me get to that point. But ultimately, I had to learn to love myself, and I had to learn to love the parts of myself that I had banished for so long. And now, having gone through that, yeah, I just have such a different relationship with myself now. Mm-hmm. I have such a deeper sense of self-compassion and self-love. And I've learned that that's what true resilience is. You know, as an overachiever, as a CEO, I thought resilience was pushing harder, just figuring things out. And if I was tired, you know, keep going, like grit, right? That was my notion of resilience 10 years ago. Now, my understanding of resilience is about having self-compassion and having an inner sense of worthiness that's not just dictated by the external, right? And when we have that, then we can take risks and fail because we know we're going to be okay no matter what happens.
And that's a powerful place to find yourself. And it's interesting how powerful, you know, the inner child work comes up in almost every type of journey that people go on, that reconnecting with that lost child or the encapsulated younger self or that wounded inner child. I always love the work of Lucia Capocchioni. She was actually the first one to do a whole drawing to the inner child. She has like a series of coloring books, drawing books, and writing with your opposite hand. And I found that to be a super powerful way for people to tap into that inner child experience, is writing with your non-dominant hand. Like, it somehow brings the circuits, you know, into place. And to see when people have those moments of connection with the, and I love your term, your encapsulated younger self, that little child that's been held inside of you to be protected. When you finally tap into it, it must have been an incredible experience, especially because you worked so hard to get there and it seems it came to you mm-hmm. when you weren't trying or when you're trying less.
Yes. And it comes back to this idea of surrender, right? When mm-hmm. we just stop doing, like the answer is there within us. Mm-hmm. So how do we pause long enough to discover that, right? Instead of this like constant seeking, just knowing that it's there within us. Right. Yes. And I'm so grateful. You know, I think healing really happens in community. It's not something that happens in isolation. And I'm so, so grateful for every friend, teacher, healer, therapist who has helped me in this journey. Because, yes, the answer was within, but I had to be supported and held by others to find that for myself.
And you had to believe it was possible, too. You know, you had positive experiences with Bess along the way and Dick Schwartz and you know, the other healings. I want to talk about the psychedelics as well, because that's so new on the cusp of the world. If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Jane Shen. We're talking about her book, Like a Wave We Break, a memoir of falling apart and finding myself. I read the whole thing in just about one sitting, by the way. I don't think I said that to you earlier, because it just pushed me along and pushed me along and pushed me along. And the therapist in me, you know, was fascinated by all the connections. And the psychedelics must have been interesting, because I'm assuming it was before the certifications and legality of psychedelics was coming to the forefront, correct?
Yeah.
You had to be a little covert.
I had to be a little covert. I started reading, you know, I read Michael Pollan's book, and I started like looking at all the data and the clinical studies and everything that you know, has been done around psychedelics. I've experimented with a few, but the one I write about in the book is MDMA, mm-hmm. Which the clinical studies on MDMA have been conducted with veterans primarily who have PTSD, and the results have been really remarkable. You know, they've shown that veterans who have been doing talk therapy for many years and who haven't made progress are actually able to make significant progress with just three MDMA-assisted journeys. And so I got very, very, you know, was very fascinated by this, and found a guide to work with and tried this for myself. And I agree. I think there's something that is really groundbreaking about this, because as we discussed earlier, like trauma doesn't live in your thinking brain. And so being able to access deeper levels of consciousness is a really important part of healing. What MDMA does specifically, as far as I understand, is it works with a part of our brain responsible for fear, amygdala, right? And so we are amygdalas. And so we don't, we have less fear, and as a result, kind of more compassion, more open-heartedness. We also have kind of this influx of serotonin happening in our brains that leads to a more compassionate state. And what I experienced in those journeys was just much deeper compassion for myself, being able to see myself for who I truly was mm-hmm. for the first time, and being able to see my family differently, my parents specifically, right? Really understanding their stories in a much deeper way. And I still reflect on those experiences often, because they showed me the true nature of who I was. I remember this one point in my first MDMA journey. I remember seeing this beautiful light and just, you know, feeling the glow of the light, the texture of the light, and then realizing, oh, that's me. Mm. I am that light. Mm. You know, and that's not only the light in me, but the light in all of us, when we can let go of our fears and our ego. That's what becomes possible, that we are just beings of love. So how do we remember that? How do we come back to that? And I think that psychedelics can give you a really a felt sense of that, which is incredibly healing.
How did you do the guided journeys? You know, back to back over the course of months? What was your timeline?
I did them over the course of months. I kind of followed the protocol in the clinical studies. I did mine. I did three of them over the course of a year, I believe.
Mm-hmm. because the processing piece is really important. I think, you know, people get very excited about psychedelics and the potentiality of the psychedelics, but I don't think that people are talking enough about the timeline of this, that you need to have these experiences, guided experiences, but then you need that processing and reprocessing part, because it is, it's, you know, the theme of your book, the breaking, falling apart and finding yourself, that the psychedelics do have a breaking down and a breaking apart piece that people have to process before they do their next journey. So I always get concerned, especially if people are trying to do it unguided, that they're just going to, you know, have a weekend on mushrooms and then come out a totally different person, and they're not prepared for the brokenness that you actually experience between these. I don't know if you could speak to that.
Yes. Well, this is why, to what you're talking about, integration is very important, but I think also equally important is all the work that you're doing leading up to the journey, right? Because the journey is not going to magically take you to these places. It feels like they can feel like that, but I think all of the inner work that you're doing really deepens the journey. All of these things build upon each other. There is no magic solution, as I discovered. And so those dreams, I was so glad to have been doing a lot of therapy, like before and after. The integration part is critical. And in fact, a lot of my biggest insights came to me not during the journey, but afterwards.
Yes.
And the guide I worked with really encouraged me to like take a few days off to really slow down and process and let it sink in. So I was like journaling and sitting and thinking, being in nature a lot really helped. But some of those big, big insights to me really occurred in the days after the journey. So I think you're absolutely right. And I really do think it's a mistake when someone has that mentality of like, I don't have to do the other work. You know, I just do this one thing and I'm going to be fine, because that's not how it works. Right. And there's also just like the continual maintenance of this. And this is, healing is not a linear process, as you know so well. It's not linear. There is no one size fits all solution. There is no one thing that's going to heal you. It's something that takes shape over time. And I remember in my sessions with Bessel, I'd get so impatient and I'd be like, hey, am I going to heal or what? Like, how long is this going to take? What's the timeline? What's my quarterly report? You know?
Yes.
And he would
you need to meet
me
our margins.
Patiently.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he would just sit with me very patiently and say, yes, I really do think that. And him telling me that, yes, I do believe you can heal, like really helped me believe that there could be. And until he said that, I didn't believe there could be kind of an, you know, an end point for this. And so that gave me hope. But it didn't happen on this like exact timeline. And there were moments, and you'll see in, you know, something I wanted to illustrate in the book, the non-linear fashion of healing. Because there are moments I thought I was healed and I thought I'd learned so much. And then I'd get into a relationship and learn that, you know, I was actually in kindergarten with all this stuff. And so it'd like wake me up to something bigger and deeper. Right. And so that's what I just have a very, I say, humble approach to it now, that I don't know the things I don't know. I know I've made progress. I think that that my healing journey, my personal growth journey, is something I'll continue to invest in for the rest of my life. But the key way that I know I've made progress is the inner dialogue in my head has changed. And what I mean by that is, before, I would hear just the meanest voices in my head, right? That voice that was telling me incessantly that I wasn't enough, that I was stupid, that, you know, that I was a failure or a loser or whatever that voice is. You know, we're often the meanest to ourselves. And so what I noticed over time is that voice, it's not that voice went away completely, but when it does come up, it's also replaced by another voice. The voice that tells me I am enough, that it's okay to make mistakes, that I am loved and held and supported and worthy just as I am, right? That I don't have to earn love, that I don't have to prove my worth. And so the fact that I hear that voice more often now is the biggest sign that I've made progress.
I've often wondered if we should replace the word healing with living, so that people don't have an idea that there is a place they get to that they're done. And that really the whole process of our life is about discovery and recovery and falling apart and coming together and falling apart and coming together. And I often think that it would help our whole mental health as humans if we had less expectation that there was a golden space and this idea that we're always in process. We're always in process, and to embrace each process as success. I think it would shorten, right? It would shorten the seeking that people do if we started telling children when they were in kindergarten, hey, your life is going to have a series of these falling apart and rediscoveries, and that's all okay, and you're okay. That I feel would be an important part of the love and embrace that we give to children.
I agree. And that's to know that, like, failing and breaking and all of that is a part of our life's journey, right? And sometimes the biggest breaking points lead to the biggest breakthroughs.
Absolutely.
I just actually conducted a workshop right before this call on this exact topic, right? How do those breakthroughs actually reframe things and allow us to see things differently? There's something just so beautiful about that. But again, I think that resilience that we have comes when we can have this inner worthiness, right? And this inner sense of enoughness. And when we accept all of ourselves, that's when we step into our full power.
It's a beautiful place to visit. And Jane, thank you so much for spending the hour with me. Jane Chen, author of Like a Wave, We Break, a memoir of falling apart and finding myself. Jane, if people want to connect with you, how can they find information?
Yes. Well, Like a Wave We Break is available on Amazon and any bookstore will have it as well. And for folks who want to connect with me, you can find me on my website. It's janemariechen.com. My website has lots of resources of all the best tools I've used. And for people who are wanting to do personal development or healing, I hope you will take advantage of that. And I'm also now transitioning into leadership coaching and development and keynote speaking. So for anyone interested in that, you can find me on my website.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you joining me today. This has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Find me on Facebook, Instagram, and listen to previous shows and podcast our show as well. But as always, thank you for tuning in, supporting this community, Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Too many shadows in my room. Too many corners in my mind. So much to do to set my heart right.